9:38, 22 minutes before 10 o'clock, rain ending. Cloudy skies, 62 in Brentwood this hour, 63 in Hendersonville, and we're 64 downtown at Supertalk 99.7 WTN. And I said this behind his back, and I want to say it with him on the phone live. If I wanted to talk about foreign policy or get military analysis, there is no one, if I was president of the freaking United States, that I would want to talk to more than Peter Brooks. I think he is the foremost mind and the most brilliant mind in the room. And why I have access to him is beyond me. He is a Fox regular, and I think it really is a God favor thing that I can email him, and he finds time to come on this show. So, Peter, first and foremost, always grateful for every second that you give to us. I mean that. I'm not blowing smoke up.
All right. Okay. All right.
I still don't know why you do it, to be honest with you. All right. Let's start with another brilliant article you wrote for the Boston Herald on the cost of cozying up to Cuba. Kind of walk through some of the things that are concerning to you.
Well, look, I mean, the idea that we've decided to basically legitimize this this regime is very troubling to me. I mean, I think we've gotten Cuba to the point where, I mean, a lot of people forget their history. And I actually served in Central America during the Cold War in the bad days when the Sandinistas were running around in Grenada and the Soviets were doing stuff. And I remember that. And the reason that the Cubans were able to do that is because they were supported by the Soviets. They had money to do it. They were in Angola. They were in Africa. They were supporting terrorists.
Hell, don't forget when they first popped on the scene in 62, a Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, the idea that, you know, so in other words, we're going to open up to them. We've got them at a point now where they're not causing trouble. Now, I understand the plight
for
of
six
the Cuban
months.
People.
For 6 months, they're not causing trouble. That doesn't erase 50
right,
years.
Right. Well, taking them off the terrorism list. But I understand the plight of the Cuban people. They're the victims of the Cuban government. But the idea that if we're nice to them, they're going to be nice to us is forget about it. The idea that Cuban regime is going to change because we're going to open up to them and give them more money. Remember, this is a socialist communist economy. This doesn't go to the private people. This goes through the government. That they're going to change is just folly. I mean, this the president has seen this. We've seen this before. You know, I recently couldn't believe this. And somebody was talking about one of the great successes of the Obama administration on foreign policy was Burma, and you know, some people call it Myanmar, opening up to the military junta there, and that's not changed either. What they'll do is they'll take our generosity, our economic openings, and other things, and they'll just pocket it, and they'll stay as repressive as they are. I mean, Cuba is an island prison. You know, the Wall Street Journal reported this, and I can't verify it, because they're using sources coming out of the University of Miami, but after the president announced the opening to Cuba in December, Cuba put away another 1,300 political prisoners. What does that tell you? I mean, this is just on the face of it.
How about Iranian's framework? Not even a deal yet. And right. Already we've got oil for grain, missiles being delivered. Come on. I mean, you know, this same naivete or reckless foreign policy is failing everywhere it's applied because our enemies only know strength. Appeasement always emboldens the aggressor. But there's something in your article that's brilliant that everybody is so quick to forget. And I worded it this way. And one of the hells that is my life right now is when you're speaking the truth seems like shock jock, you know, hyperbole. But the truth of the matter is Cuba hasn't changed at all.
Right.
So why are we changing our view of it? Maybe we've become a lot more socialistic. Maybe we've become a lot more communistic, but they haven't become a lot more capitalistic or liberty or freedom or equality or human rights oriented. I mean, it says, I think, nothing about Cuba, but a lot about us or, yeah, frankly, our president.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. And, you know, occasionally you talk to Europeans or Canadians and they beat up on us about, oh, you need to open up to Cuba. You know, and I said, you guys have opened up to Cuba. You've always been open up to Cuba, and it's changed nothing. It's changed nothing. I mean, you know, so I don't understand about us opening up to Cuba, how that's going to change that repressive regime. And this is the view of the president.
And best of all, they didn't have to do anything, Peter.
Right. Well, that's you can't get any better than that, can you, if you're on the opposite side? The president believes if we're nice to them, they'll be nice back to us. This was the Cairo speech after he took office. This was the outreach to Iran after he took office. This was the outreach to Russia after he took office. China is eating our lunch in Asia. This is going on all over the place, and it's this continual belief that if we're just nice to them, they'll be nice back to us. Now, that could be very true with other countries who are, you know, liberal democracies with free economies and free people, but it isn't true in the totalitarian world.
So suddenly we have an imprisoned island, communist, oppressive, totalitarian, suddenly given legitimacy.
Yeah.
And 90 miles off our coast, and with still the same dangerous friends from the former Soviet Union, now Russia, that they're cozy to Venezuela, to throughout Central America.
Yeah.
What are the not clear and present dangers, but unintended consequences or frankly intended vulnerabilities of cozying up?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, if you've put money in their pocket, they're going to use it only to further repress their people. You know, if you give them more money, they're just going to allow them to do that. Then it might also allow them. I mean, look, the leftists in Latin America are leaderless since Hugo Chavez died. Okay, he was causing a lot of problem. The Iranians were going there on a regular basis. The Russians were going there on a regular basis. He was supporting groups like the Sandinista or the you know, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, Ecuador. And Bolivia, you know, all these leftists who hated the United States. If Cuba is enriched, which would probably take some time, is enriched, I think they will also continue to try to export their anti-Americanism and in that part of the world, and they're looking for somebody to be that leader. And Maduro in Venezuela is not going to be that leader, but they're looking for somebody, and I think we're just going to see more trouble besides the fact that I don't think they're going to give up on repressing the Cuban people. One thing, Mike, that totalitarians understand, I don't care if you're talking about North Korea, you're talking about Burma, you're talking about
Russia,
Cuba.
China,
If they give the people a say, if they open up to them, they know they will lose power and they will be swept into the dustbin of history. They cannot do that because this is not how people want to live. I don't care what your nationality is, where you live. They do not want to live under
oppression. If you believe in liberty, if you believe in freedom, you don't cozy up with people like this. It's that simple.
That's what I say. You know, I'm always interested because there's been a lot of criticism of, they say that the right doesn't care about human rights.
This is more than just foreign policy recklessness and naivete. This is identity crisis crap, Peter.
Well, I mean, this is the president believed. Remember, he talked about it in his campaign that he felt he could meet with anybody without preconditions. He felt that he could sit down with anybody and talk them out of these sort of things. The left believes in the power of ideas and that instead of the national interests. And this is the difference here, and in power. This is the difference between the left. This is the difference between the left and the right. And you're seeing it played out in places like Cuba. All I can see in these deals, whether you're talking about Iran or Cuba, is a lot of give and not a lot of get.
Peter Brooks is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. He's a senior military and foreign policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation and a Fox TV go-to guy. Let me ask you the Iran deal. It looks to me, now this is a very simple way of saying it, but the president's going to try to act like he's making concessions so he can turn around and blame Congress for a deal that never happened and blew up while it was still a framework. How convenient is that?
Well, I mean, the president is betting on the fact that he can pocket 34 votes in the Congress. Remember, if, you know, say if the Congress doesn't like the deal, if they actually get to a deal, I mean, we just have a framework, you know that, right? I mean, this is all still up in the air, and you see what the Iranians are saying about sanctions lifted automatically, immediately, et cetera, et cetera. And what is happening here is the president believes he can get 34 votes out of the Senate on this, because if the Congress doesn't like it, they have 30 days to say no, and the House and Senate, they send a resolution of disapproval, a joint resolution of disapproval to the president. The president will veto it, and for them to overturn that, they need 67 votes in the Senate. They probably would have it in the House, but they would need 67 votes in the Senate, and the president believes that he can get 34, so that means they would only have 66, at least 34, to support him, so they wouldn't be able to sustain the override the veto. And I think that's what the legislative strategy is here. And the president, what he wanted to do is get Congress to be quiet about this issue so they could go back to negotiating.
We don't do a lot of farming in America anymore, Peter, but my father used to have a great expression, don't count your chickens before they hatch. I'd like to know how you're getting there. Russia's movement with the missile sales as well as oil and grain deals is probably going to spook this coalition. So I don't know how you're going to get the entire coalition through this framework to an actual deal. Plus, you got the leadership in Iran saying unless the sanctions are completely lifted from day one, and we never said anything about unfettered access to all of our facilities, it doesn't sound like they even have a framework, and they sure as hell don't have a deal. Congress and the president are battling out approval for something that's never going to happen.
I don't quibble with much of what you said, but it isn't a, you know, P5+1 negotiation. It's a Iran-U.S. negotiation. Okay, the others are just window dressing. They're not playing a significant role. You know, perhaps they could come down. And in fact, in some cases, they've been more hardline. I think the French have been more hardline than we have. But it really is between John Kerry and you know, the.
But Peter, it's all right out in the open. They clearly don't have a framework for missiles. Ballistic
missiles
aren't included. They clearly don't have an understanding over when the sanctions will be lifted.
Yeah,
and clearly this now enters, thanks to Russia's provocation, this missile delivery. This was the red line from a year, or how many years ago? That's certainly problematic. I don't know how the president's going to sell this to himself.
Mike, look, you know, the way it often works in business is unfortunate, especially with foreign partners, is that the negotiating starts after the contract is signed, okay?
Well.
And this is sometimes the way it is with treaties, because what they try to do, if you're trying to, and especially in arms control, if you're trying to limit somebody doing something, they're going to look for wiggle room. Okay, think about any contract. I don't care if it's business, personal, or otherwise. And the same thing with, you know, these sort of international agreements. People are always looking for things that will support, and this is why lawyers are, you know, play a very big role in these sort of things. And the Iranians are going to say, this is, and then you have foreign languages involved, right? So, you know, there's real challenges there. And this is why, even though you may, whether you say we have a framework or not, I mean, we can disagree on that. The real tough negotiations is going to happen between now and if they're able to.
And in the end, Peter, the problems are all the same. It doesn't roll back their D-Day with having a weapon of mass destruction. It freezes it, and that's
exactly
a joke if
you
believe
that. That's what I said. You know, I said right afterwards, this freezes it. And I saw this up close and personal when I was a Capitol Hill staffer in the late 1990s when I was involved in doing oversight on the North Korean nuclear agreement, and we saw what happened a few years later after that agreement, the one that was concluded under the Clinton administration.
If I can have one last question, then I want to read something from a listener to you, so maybe it'll take 2 minutes tops. But you know, it's a proxy war with Russia in Syria. It's a proxy war with Russia in Iran. I mean, let's not be naive about this. Everybody is acting up. I think that's been very provocative for Putin to jump.
Oh, that's what the missile sales are about. I mean, the missile sales are not just about, you know, making money from Iran, which is important.
No, Russia only exports shoving it right up Obama's rear end.
Well, I mean, you know, Russia exports energy and weapons. That's what they do. That's their economy, okay? And that's why when the oil price is so low, they're really in trouble. But the fact of the matter is this is about what's happening with the missiles in Iran is about Ukraine, about the sanctions.
Are we focused enough on Russia and what they're up to?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think we have much influence. And unfortunately, if you make them part of the P5+1 negotiations, then you have to play along with them because they potentially do have some influence. If you want the permanent five powers of the UN Security Council to sign off on this agreement, then you need to have some sort of agreement with Russia. So this is what you've done. You've given leverage to others on these international.
So you have the missile sales jumping on Iran, and then you have the ships in the English Channel. You got the aircraft in airspace. I mean,
well, we've talked about this. We know what Russia's up to. I mean, there's no doubt. There's no doubt about it. They're trying to return Russia to its former glory, and part of that is they see the United States as being in the way.
And weak. This one comes from a person who served our country, as you have. He writes, could you ask Peter Brooks about the imminent fall of Ramadi in Iraq? My brothers and I sacrificed so much in Fallujah and Ramadi in that corridor in my 2004 deployment, and so did so many others afterwards, to keep it out of the hands of al-Qaeda and extremists. Now this administration is just going to, he uses a word for pee it away, so easily, all that we fought and bled for. You know, that's kind of lost in all this conversation. I mean, I know we bring it up and we say it in a line on their behalf, but these are men whose lives are never going to be the same. They lost brothers in the fight. They risked their lives. They did so much to liberate Iraq. And we're just, I mean, I think it's official. We've already peed it away, haven't we?
Well, it's a tragedy, and the administration made, and I have many friends and relatives who actually, you know, served there, and there in Afghanistan and other things. And being a veteran myself, I completely sympathize with your listener. But the administration made a huge mistake when they left Iraq. They opened it up to ISIS and to Iranian influence, and that's what we're dealing with today.
Peter Brooks, read his work, this time in the Boston Herald, always at heritage.org, and look for him on Fox News. Virtually daily, and always finding time for us in Nashville. I'm very, very grateful, Peter. I love you, brother.
Thanks
Have a great weekend.
Okay, take care. You too.